This year, our podcast will explore the multi-layered experiences which encompass Ireland's past, and will also put into context how the sense of heritage is all about our collective experience, and why so much that went before still resonates in the present. I hope you enjoy the show. Ireland's network of heritage officers are employed by local authorities in partnership with the Heritage Council. This initiative was started by the Heritage Council in 1999 and has been supported by them ever since through funding and technical support. Based all around the country, heritage officers play a key role in promoting awareness, pride, and conservation for biodiversity and heritage. In today's podcast, our guest is Shirley Clerkin, heritage officer with Monaghan County Council, who's also a member of the local authority Heritage Officer Network. Shirley explains the importance of this partnership, the work of heritage officers, the value of biodiversity and heritage for sustainable development, and what we can do to be part of the solutions for biodiversity. On with the show. Shirley Clerkin, heritage officer with Monaghan County Council. How are you keeping?
I'm just fantastic. Thank you, Greg. Thanks.
And I know this is going to be a positive conversation because we had a positive chat before we hit record.
Well, it's just so lovely to talk to a person, isn't it, as well? But yeah, I'm feeling positive today. I have to say this, the sun's shining, you know, it's spring, which is always a great time.
Yeah, it is a lovely time when you see things coming alive again.
Yeah, it's a reassurance, isn't it, that spring comes around every year. You know, the buds start coming on the trees and the birds are pairing up and singing. So I think particularly the season of spring just has a real resonance, a real feel-good factor.
Nature isn't leaving us down, it's coming back again.
Yeah, it is really reassuring, isn't it? It's like the sun coming up every day. Even if you've been feeling grim before you go to bed, you wake up and there's the sun. Maybe it's rain, but the daylight anyway. And like spring, just the emergence of spring. And I know last year, you know, our very first lockdown, that was the thing that people just kept harking back about. It was just such a fabulous spring. But really, was it a fabulous spring, or had we just noticed spring? Had we just slowed down sufficiently to allow us to actually look at the trees in more detail, or hear the bird song gradually come into our lives, or notice little things walking the children to school or whatever? Spring brings with it that reassurance and nurturing that we really need.
I remember during the worst of lockdown, you know, being trapped at home and actually sitting out the back in the sunshine and listening to the birds and the trees whistling away and thinking, yeah, I might stay out here a little bit longer. It wasn't.
I brought my laptop outside a few days, you know. I felt very cosmopolitan in my back garden.
Yeah, it's really difficult, though, to look at the screen, is it, when it's a little bit too bright?
Oh, it is. But if you position a big umbrella over your head and over the laptop at the same time, it can be done.
Okay, you have it correct.
I have.
So would you tell me about your role and maybe the role of your 27 other warriors around the country? Because I think the way the network works is, I think within each local authority, is there a dedicated heritage officer?
Yeah, well, in most local authorities, there are one or two little gaps, which the Heritage Council are hoping to fill. So there are a local authority heritage officer, I suppose, in most of the county councils or city councils around the country. And I have fantastic colleagues, I have to say. I'm blessed with the network that we have. It's a great support, actually, even though we're all more or less standalone officers in our local authority, that we have that network and we have that support and mentoring network with each other. It's just a fantastic community. But the Heritage Council established the Heritage Officer Programme, I think in the end of 1999, as a pilot programme to fulfil their partnership role with organisations. And so they started off with a few heritage officers, and then gradually the program built from there. And we have a kind of a very, I would call it an eco-cultural social role, in that we work with natural heritage. So we work with biodiversity, wildlife, nature, but we also work with a much longer time frame. So we work with geology and landscape, and also then with the social aspect of things, with archaeology and maybe artifacts, but very importantly, all of that and people. So we're very eco-centric, but we're also human-focused. So We work with the humans in our local authority and we work with the humans in our counties, and we work obviously with them with the plants and the rich archaeology that we have and the wildlife as well. So it's a great, great role, very holistic. So you're really all the time looking at the interconnectivity of everything and how you might be at a graveyard, for example, which would be have fantastic, you know, old headstones in it, maybe dating back to the 1700s with amazing folk art and stone masonry on them, maybe a medieval church ruin. But you're also then looking at what plants are in the graveyard and whether there are bats there and who are the local community who look after the graveyard and why are they interested in it. So all of those kind of significant factors that really come together to really make much more of the parts separately, to look at them in a much more holistic way. So our role really, you couldn't not be enthusiastic about it. I always keep saying it's the best job in the local authority. It really is. It's just so rich. And I know my colleagues would agree with me wholeheartedly on that.
So it's a huge role, a colossal A to Z. But
yes.
but you're that lone warrior within the county, you know, with that responsibility. So
yes.
You need to be fairly light on your feet in terms of getting other people on board within the authority, other stakeholders, the general public. How do you even go about that work? How long are you in the role, by the way?
Well, I'm in the role since the very last month of 2004. So that's quite some time. I joined Monaghan County Council after 4 or 5 years in environmental NGOs, the non-governmental sector. So it was quite a change actually for me going to a local authority. I had never watched The Office programme and understood it until after I was in the local authority for a while. And I mean that with no ill will to anybody, but I didn't understand office politics at all.
And were you the first heritage officer in Monaghan County Council?
I was. And, you know, all of the heritage officers at the beginning, certainly for the first 10 years, were the first heritage officers in their local authorities. So you had to be able to carve out your role and persuade both your colleagues and the senior staff and the community at large and the local councillors as to the importance of heritage. And I remember like very much having to explain what heritage was, and people really thought it was mostly castles at the beginning. And I went on the local radio station and I asked them, could I go on every week and explain a different aspect of heritage? So I went on for a few weeks and each week I took a different area. So maybe I did graveyards, and then I'd look at, you know, megalithic tombs, and then I talk about landscape or drumlins because I'm from Monaghan, so loads of drumlins, and maybe wildlife and buildings or whatever, just to give people an overview. But I find now, 15 years later, you don't really have to do that anymore. People actually do understand much more what heritage is in its roundness. And the Heritage Council have done studies on this going back, and you can see that there is a sense of, there's a growing understanding and appreciation in the amongst the general public about what heritage actually encompasses and how it can contribute to their lives. Not just about looking backwards, I would say. I would say heritage is very much about looking forwards and what can we bring forwards into a sustainable future. You know, so it's that thread. It's the thread that binds everything together from the past, but it's the thread that goes into the future as well. And I very, very much feel that it really can be at the center of a new way of living for everybody, you know, new sustainable livelihoods and a new sustainable way of living that we have to actually merge into. We have to transition towards. Otherwise, it's going to be very, very difficult for our children and our grandchildren. And, you know, we all care about those people. We mightn't even have met them yet, but we care about them because when we look back at our ancestors, we know that they did things for us so that we would be here and that we would have comfortable lives and, you know, successful lives. Maybe your parents maybe struggled to put people through university or through apprenticeships or, you know, getting them set up in some sort of a, you know, livelihood or whatever. And it's a kind of similar idea. What assets are we looking after now? What capital are we bringing forward for our children and grandchildren? What kind of a place do we want them to live in?
In the conversation that we were having at the beginning, before we hit record, it's easy to drop into this despondency.
Yes.
Everything is a crisis, but I know you don't view it in that way at all.
No, and I have to honestly admit that I do suffer from, I would get worried about it, obviously, and I read reports and, you know, they actually pain me. First, they would give me an emotional pain, some of the reports, particularly about biodiversity loss and wildlife extinctions. But then within that, you see who are the helpers. It's a bit like looking at the first responders, and you think, you know, if you see an accident, you go, okay, that's terrible. But then you're always told to look for who are the helpers, who are the first responders. And if you look for those people, I think it gives you a great sense of optimism. So if you look for the farmers that are doing something good for biodiversity and try to focus on them and say, okay, those are people who are trying to make a difference, and they're trying to buck the system to show how they can actually contribute to better pollinator services on their farm. They're growing their hedgerows out, they're leaving wildlife strips, they're going into the GLOS scheme and they're trying their best. Or, you know, you're looking at a community group who's trying to save a wetland, and they're doing it for not themselves, they're doing it for the greater good, and they're contributing to it, and it's making them feel good. So look for the first responders, look for the helpers. And I think if you do that, you can see that there are so many people who really want to be part of the solution. Once they understand that it is evidence-based, that, you know, you're not telling them stories, you're not bringing them down the garden path with, you know, pessimism or doom and gloom, but you're genuinely saying there is evidence here that there are disasters happening in the environment, but they're actually, particularly for biodiversity, there are things everybody can do. Because biodiversity is very local. Nature is local. It's outside your door. It's on the tree. It's in the hedge. You know, it's in your local park or whatever. It's extremely local. So local actions matter for it.
And can we find those first responders everywhere?
Absolutely. I mean, I think you find them in the most unexpected places. And it's, you can sow the seeds of greatness in anybody. They can be sown in anyone. And sometimes people come into, particularly, you know, biodiversity from a cultural angle. You know, I find often, and I know my heritage officer colleagues would agree with me with this, particularly older people who would have affinity towards particular cultural sites, or, you know, ruins or castles or graveyards, or, you know, an archaeological site in their community, they'd have great affinity with that site and they'd have folklore about it and everything. And they'll start coming into heritage from that. But then they start coming on other trips. They go on different events when we were allowed to have events. And people start, you know, coming to like bat walks. Have you ever been on a bat walk, Greg?
No, never.
Okay, well, you really must go on a bat walk. And I remember about 12 years ago, we held our very first, or maybe longer, first bat walk in Monaghan Town in Rossmore Forest Park. And we were doing it with Bat Conservation Ireland, who are a fantastic non-governmental organisation that look after bats. And at 9 o'clock or 8 o'clock, because you have to have them in the evening time, there were only three people there. And I was like, oh, gee, this is a disaster. There's only three people come, when we'd adverts on the radio and everything. And then in typical Monaghan fashion, right on the hour, a stream of cars started coming into the car park, and I could see their lights, and I was going, oh my God. And they still were coming in. And I was like, oh my goodness. And I thought, maybe they're coming to something else. Is there something else on? Is there a rave in the park? And no, lo and behold, they were coming to the bat walk. And we had the most phenomenal night, because people had never heard bats before, seen bats. And we had echolocator devices, or like little radio transistor radios. And we were handing them out and putting them on particular frequencies, and people could hear the echolocation sounds the bats were making, and they were astounded. We watched them catching insects flying over the lakes. We walked in through the woodland in the pitch black, and it was phenomenal. And people came up to me afterwards and went, oh my God, Shirley, we're so glad you came to Monaghan. I was going, but I'm from Monaghan. And they're going, oh no, we're so glad you came to Monaghan. We would never have seen a bat. We would never have heard a bat. But that to me said something. That said to me, people want to discover. They just need to be given the opportunity. They need to be given the choices to make available to them a discovery. So it's like, we've done this great booklet called Gardening for Biodiversity, the Local Authority Heritage Officer Network. And I'll hold it up so you can see how beautiful the cover is. Gorgeous.
It absolutely is.
And, you know, within that, we cover what's biodiversity, why it's important, you know, and like, it is our life support system. It provides everything we need. It provides us with clean water, clean air, you know, pollination. So our insects, and insects, of course, are food for birds. But as well as that, they provide pollination services for fruit and vegetables. So, you know, if we want to be healthy, if we want humanity to have health and well-being, then we need these ecosystem services and we need to value them. And, you know, in our Gardening for Biodiversity booklet, which is only a small thing, you know, we make very small, easy, how to do it steps really for anybody with a garden or anybody with a window box, you know, on what you can do. And like, this is May, as you know, it's the International Month for Biodiversity. So, you know, we're calling on people to do small things in their gardens or, you know, in a pot at their front door for pollinators, to pledge their gardens for pollinators.
Where can people get that book, Shirley?
So we can get it through the libraries. You can get it online or you can get it through any local authority heritage officer. If you get in touch with us, we'll send them out in the post. Absolutely no bother. And we've sent out thousands and thousands and thousands of them already. And they've been really, really successful because it's a how can you, what can you do? And everybody can do something. And if you look at humanity, maybe we are gardeners. You know, maybe humans are gardeners, Homo sapiens. Maybe that's what we've been doing all along in the planet. Maybe if you look at other species, they're doing different things, but maybe that's our role. But maybe we've been kind of over-egging it a bit. Through our intensive gardening, which might be called food production, we've forgotten about all of the other things that you need to do when you garden. So you need to look after the other species and the habitats that provide us with the services that allow us to garden. Or simply, we won't just have the variety that we have now. And certainly, we won't have the resilience in our landscape that we need and that we particularly need at the moment, you know, in this climate crisis. Like, there's no other word for it at this stage. We can't even call it climate change. It's gone above 420, you know, parts per million, I think, this month. I think we never thought we'd get that high, even in nearly in the worst case scenarios. So, you know, we really need to think about what creating something rather than consuming, I would say.
And in a way, I'm listening to you talk and you're making a huge argument and presenting it in such an attractive way. In some respects, I think we need to do our own version of gardening on ourselves, which is educating ourselves and giving ourselves the knowledge and the belief that what we can do will make a difference. And there's simple things, as you've been describing, but maybe we don't even realize that. And maybe the starting point is education and, you know, getting people enthused. And belief, I think, is a big part of all of that. So I must get my book.
I think that's fantastic. You know, I think you're right. You need to know a little bit, but as well as that, in another sense, you don't really need to know that much, because what you can do is just stop doing something. You know, you can leave a mess in the corner of your garden. You can stop mowing an area and leave it and let the nettles grow and let your hedgerows bloom. So in fact, you can stop doing something and nature in some senses will look after itself and it will start coming back. I mean, my garden, just as for an example, when my garden started here, it was just a really rough grassy field with really thick grass in it. You couldn't walk through it at all. But I planted trees, planted a hawthorn hedge with holly in it and ash trees in it, planted some native trees in the garden, dug out a pond. And my garden now, as I would call my garden now a woodland. It's no longer a traditional garden. It's a woodland and there's woodland species in it. And it's just phenomenal. And that took 10, 12 years for that really just to grow. And I don't actually do any gardening. Okay. I actually don't garden really. I cut back a little bit here and there every now and again, but that's all. And it really looks after itself and it looks after me. And it looks after all of the animals that and the birds that are here. But likewise, before I lived here, I had a very, very tiny garden in a housing estate. And I planted one lovely tree in the front garden because that's all there was room for. And I have to say and admit my guilty secret that often I go and visit my tree to check on it.
Well, that's okay. It's your tree after all.
To see how it's doing. And it's the most beautiful tree still in the housing estate that I lived in. And it's just gorgeous. And I know that all the neighbors must appreciate it because it's just so lovely. And, you know, so I think there's little things that we can do and believe that those little things make a difference. And I think you're right. There is a little bit of belief in it. And just you can be your own local champion. And, you know, we are in a time of crisis and change. And this pandemic you know, is we look back on this and we go, oh my God, that was so weird. That was just beyond weird. We all were stuck in our houses and we weren't allowed to talk to our friends and we weren't allowed to hug anybody. And those nurturing activities that we used to do, maybe by the increasing activity that people have found themselves, or people have found themselves increasingly to be in nature, to be in parks. And maybe that's an inherent want in people, you know, because there are things that are emitted from green plants and from trees, phytokines, and they are very good for your immune system. They're immune system boosters. So actually, maybe we don't even know it, but we've been finding ourselves in nature more and more, going for more and more walks, not because we've been told to keep healthy, but maybe because we're feeling better because of it. But there's actually scientific proof that it does make you physiologically better and mentally better. And over in England, they have been prescribing nature prescriptions, giving people a dose of nature and recommending that people go out, particularly people with depression and other illnesses, to spend time in nature, even 10 minutes, going out for 15, gradually increasing their time because of the benefits that it brings. So all of these nature-based solutions, I think we need to expand our idea of what self-care is. You know, so maybe we say self-care is, you know, having a glass of wine, which I love myself, and maybe taking the wine out into your garden, or even sitting beside a plant in your house and having your wine, okay? Or, you know, self-care is having, you know, bringing your children out. We were talking about this, bringing your children out to the park. And so what if you don't know the names of all the plants? They don't know what they're called either. But you might notice, oh, well, those plants only grow in shady areas. Or particular plants like to be beside the water. Or you might notice different insects on the water than you'd notice in the trees. So even that is a starting point to notice that everything has its little niche without having to burden yourself with loads and loads of knowledge. And then there are great resources out there at the moment. And spring is a great time to get into maybe butterflies, because there aren't that many species of them. There's only like over 30 in Ireland. And there's a great resource on the Biodiversity Data Centre on identification of butterflies. And let me tell you, children will identify these far quicker than you will, because their eyes are quicker, their brains are softer, they can absorb information. I mean, you know the way children can identify brands, and they'll know all of the logoed brands, and they'll know them, and they know all of them from the shops and from advertisements and all of that. That's because they're very good. Children's observation skills are really well honed, and they will remember things so much better than you will. So use them, you know, let them learn and let them teach you. It's a win-win situation all around, really.
And they can even capture those observations, can't they, and participate in biodiversity through the Citizen Science Portal?
Yeah, imagine you can become a citizen science and a scientist, and you can contribute to the national data set. I think it's just fantastic. So you can go online and record your early spring flowers. It's really simple app to use. I mean, if you can use any app on your phone, you can use the biodiversity data app, and basically just click in the map where you are or where you've seen the plants. And then you just, you know, scroll down and choose what you've seen. And, you know, your children can do it. You can do it. You can also pledge your garden online and say what you're going to do. And then, you know, join a community of like-minded people. And everybody's learning.
You mentioned the pledge for your garden. What does that mean?
Yeah, we have this. The local authority heritage officers have a program this year. It's called, I'll hold it up just to show you. It's Pledge Your Garden for Pollinators. And really, it's because obviously our pollinating insects are in decline. You know, one third of our bee species are under threat of extinction. And you might think that all bees are the same, but they're not. And they all like different habitats. And obviously, the more types of species you have and the more variety of anything you have, the more protection there is. You know, once you have a monoculture of anything, it's at risk of disease, pests, all of that. And it's at a risk of extinction. So we really need all these pollinators. And we have a little pledge your garden for pollinator. Do a few things that you can help pollinators with. So, for example, don't mow a section of your grass for May to let red clover and white clover bloom.
That's magic to my ears.
Yes. Save on your petrol in your lawnmower and protect pollinate. And white clover and red clover are really lovely little flowers. And, you know, the pollinating insects love them. They're really sweet nectar. And also, of course, the dandelions will come up. And we don't understand why people start to hate dandelions so much, because you can even put them in a salad.
And they're beautiful to look at.
And they're beautiful to look at. I mean, they're such a vibrant yellow. And the pinks and the whites of the clovers are just phenomenal. So, you know, leave a little corner, let some, or leave your whole lawn and, you know, just suck up the cutting of it in June and say, look, I'm just going to, it's going to be more difficult maybe to cut. But if you did that gradually every year, your grass actually becomes a lot easier to cut, because the little flower species aren't as thick as the rye grass you'd normally have in your lawn. And they gradually, once they're not competing with the strong grasses, you know, they become, your grass becomes a lot lighter and, you know, sort of nicer to look through. You can lie on it and look at the heads of the flowers at your level, you know, and be a child. I mean, do you remember looking at flowers when you were a child?
Yeah, probably. But that wasn't yesterday or the day before.
No, but me either. But I still remember being quite small and looking at hedges and being at that height. And you saw things at that height. So, you know, what I say is, don't mow your lawn for May. And then, you know, take out your blanket or don't, and have a little lie in it. And look at your flowers from eye level and just see how beautiful they are.
Yeah, I remember knowing the names of everything.
That's fantastic.
And now not knowing the names for most things.
Yeah, but Ian and Ilana says it doesn't matter. They don't know what they are called either.
Yeah, we can make up our own names.
Exactly. Look, we're the ones who are classifying them and calling them, you know, different scientific names. And obviously, that's extremely important for science, you know, because we need to classify what we have so that we can look at those shifting baselines so that we know, in fact, that one third of the bee species are endangered. We only know that because scientists are able to monitor them, and also because citizen scientists are actually contributing records. So we're gathering information the whole time. And that's one of the things the Heritage Officer Programme does, is this kind of trying to collect baseline information on habitats or archaeology or whatever, so that we know what we have, so that we can track this. And I don't want to say the word loss, but it generally is loss. Or wouldn't it be great to track improvement? Wouldn't that be just so good for your soul? If instead of all of the time, the trends heading south, we were actually looking at them and our shifting baseline was going upwards. I mean, do you listen to the Dawn Chorus ever? I mean, this is obviously the month for listening to the Dawn Chorus, or you could listen to the Dusk Chorus if you're lazy, right?
I think in a way, what you're saying is, wouldn't it be wonderful to be able to track performance?
Yes.
But in a way, you can literally witness it. If
you
grab your little book about your biodiversity in your own garden, you can transform it in your own world and let the guy next door, the girl next door, do exactly the same, and so on and so on. So, within your role in Monaghan County Council, and you're so enthusiastic and just vibrant about everything that you're doing, how do you get that to spread? How do you make this one person in Monaghan with this very, very broad responsibility, but it's narrow at the same time? How can you spread the word?
We spread it through others, you know, so we use interconnectivity, you know, so we have a County Monaghan Heritage Forum, and all of the counties have one of these. And so it's a mix of local councillors and local community volunteers. You know, they might be historians, or they may be botanists, or, you know, wildlife recorders. And then we have, you know, state agencies and that. So that's one thing that we do. So we have meetings and we say what we're going to do every year through our heritage and biodiversity plans, like the activities that we're going to undertake. So we'll be collecting information and we'll be doing awareness programs every year, for example. Like normally we'd have loads of events and, you know, as we were talking about the bat walk, for example, or wildflower ID walks and, you know, workshops about wetlands, for example, which is a real passion of mine. But as well as that, we try to set little fires. Now, I don't mean an actual fire, obviously. It's a bad idea to do that. But try and enthuse individuals, and so that there's lots of little champions. And we do that through spreading the word and working with community groups. So, you know, as I'm saying, even if you're working with a community group on a graveyard, you're looking at the bluebells under the trees, you know, in the graveyard, or vice versa. If you're on a wetland site, you're saying, well, my good, you know, there were artifacts found here. They're now in the National Museum, or they're in the local museum, or there's megalithic tombs here as well. So you're trying to build a story all the time and to give people links in. But as well as being the need to be a bit highbrow with the science, obviously, to make our scientific reports, which we do make on wetlands or hedgerows or whatever, to also be respectful of where people are and say, well, it doesn't matter how much you know, you can still be involved. And we're all, as I say, we're all learning. I mean, every year I have to refresh my memory about what the spring flowers are called and the different butterflies. I have to go back over my swatches because I just simply don't retain. I'm not one of those people. I'm a bigger holistic thinker and I'm not fantastic at remembering, you know, the nuts and bolts of everything. And so every year I have to relearn things. And all the time I'm learning in my job and I'm learning from local people. This is the other thing. It's a sharing. So I might know something, but you may know something much more interesting. You might know a story about it. And the guy next door, he may know something else. So you're piecing together a puzzle of fragmented information. So it's a bit like being a bit of a detective, I find. And that's what it's so good about being a heritage officer. It's the discovery. You're always discovering.
And I know when we were chatting earlier, you were saying to me, one of the things that you miss are those fireside conversations. Oh. And you mentioned the super sir. So obviously there's enthusiastic people in every corner of Monaghan who are putting on the kettle for Shirley so they can talk about those things they're equally passionate about.
Oh, I mean, they're fantastic. And these people, they're not just in Monaghan, but I mean, obviously they're fantastic here, but they're, I mean, all across the country. I've sat in kitchens in all kinds of houses, stood in barns, stood in fields, I've stood in all kinds of environments, all kinds of weathers with people who are just so enthusiastic, knowledgeable about their local area, want to share it with somebody and are delighted, like really delighted when someone, you know, shares their enthusiasm. I mean, I've stood in, you know, engineering sheds with people doing forge welding, you know, putting rivets in machinery that they're, you know, restoring. And I mean, it's just absolutely fascinating. And, you know, it's because you're talking to someone who knows what they're talking about and they've done it. Or, you know, there's a blacksmith in Monaghan who spent years learning all of the old crafts in the old way that they did it. And he spent years trying to figure out how the old gates were made. And that kind of dedication to your craft, I just love that. When somebody is really knowledgeable about something in particular, you know, heritage in particular, I always say. Yeah. You know, there's a big holistic thing, which absolutely, but there's the heritage in particular, those little tiny snippets, which are just fascinating. Well, I find them fascinating, but I might be a bit of an anorak. You know
I
what
don't
I mean?
Think so.
Because people are fascinating, you know?
Yeah, people are fascinating. There's no doubt about that. So for National Biodiversity Week, is there few things you can leave the listener with as brilliant things that someone can do on that week? That's not just for the week, but they're things that we're going to begin doing. We're going to start doing on this week that are going to take us forward. Give me the Shirley Clerkin wisdom.
Okay, well, I think, first of all, I definitely would say, please leave an area of your garden go wild. It doesn't matter if it's a cut-off corner and you want to still have your immaculate lawn, leave a little bit. The nettles will come up. Nettles are so important for butterflies. And, you know, other little bits of species will come up and leave an area. And if you're one of those people who really loves tidiness and just find it really difficult, sort of just breathe in, breathe out, have a look at it gradually, let it develop, you know, and have a little look to see what's in there. Why not? And also maybe plant some, you know, bulbs to flower for next year. So maybe some snowdrop bulbs or a few things like that to come up for next year so that you're creating a bit of an investment for next year. The other thing I'd say is, and I mentioned it earlier, would be, can you just maybe not mow your lawn or some of your lawn, half your lawn, entirely not for me, and lie in it and look at it and appreciate it. And I think to start appreciating these little things a little bit more. Also, to make the switch, and please ban pesticides, don't use them. If you use them, avoid using them during May. Why not try not using them for a few months and see how long you can go? You know, sort of give them up for a while. See how long you can stretch it. A bit like, you know, no alcohol month. or Movember when you're growing a moustache. Just see how long you can go with it. Start in May and stretch it out as far as you can and see if you can live with no pesticides. And I bet you can. And they do poison bees and lots of other species. So I would really encourage people to do that. The other thing I would say is, you know, our senses are really important. And go out and smell something, go out and smell the hawthorn, go and smell the gorse. It's an absolutely amazing smell. It smells like vanilla or coconut. I mean, it is stunningly gorgeous. Just watch the thorns, obviously. But don't prick your nose with a big thorn in the gorse. But smell it. It's stunning. And maybe as well, I was talking to someone about this the other day, the Dawn Chorus. They were saying that actually their children have never heard the Dawn Chorus because they live in a housing estate where it's not possible. There are no trees, so there's no birds singing. And what a loss, you know, that has been part of the human experience from since we've been on this planet. You know, the songs of birds, we have evolved with them. Our language has evolved from the songs of birds, you know, so get out, maybe not for the Dawn Chorus if it's too early for you, and listen to it one morning in May. Just open the window maybe in your bedroom and listen to it. Or if you can't do that, go out and listen to them at dusk when they're all going to bed, when they're getting ready and they're shuffling their spaces around on the branches. Have a listen to them then, or bring your children somewhere where they can hear the dawn or the dusk chorus. Because that is a sound that we need, that nurtures us. And I think in order for us to appreciate these shifting bass lines and to appreciate that we need them to go upwards, we need to start and hear and experience what humans need to experience. And so I think those would be my big things, you know, for May, including obviously pledging your garden for wildlife, I think would be really fantastic.
Maybe we can download that app as well.
Oh, the app is phenomenal. Yeah, the biodiversity app, the Citizens app. Download it. You can have it on your phone so you can be out and about and use it. And there are lots of ID apps you can have on your phone when you're at the park with your children or even just with yourself as well. And if you take a photograph of something and then go back to your computer and then just, you know, click on, you know, Wildfires of Ireland website, Zoe Devlin's website, which is color coded for all the flowers, it's really easy then to figure out what you've got. So, you know, have a little look around. There are fantastic resources out there. And there's a fantastic community of people as well. All kinds of humans all around the country who are already, you know, taking part in activities like this. And I have to say that the salt of the earth, these people, and, you know, we'd love to have more and more people join and to work with us and to enjoy it. I think that's the main thing. We're not talking about sacrificing here. We're talking about creating, not consuming, experiencing, not sacrificing. And I think that's the whole thing that we need to get, that we can be those people. We can be transformative, and we can transform ourselves in the process as well, Greg, of course. I do believe it's an era of transformation. I believe it's an era of renaissance. I believe it's an era where we can shift the baselines. You know, we can be those good ancestors. We can. We just need to know how to go about it. And there's loads of people out there who are willing to help you, and lots of resources as well. And a huge community of people who have already adopted, you know, some of these things in their lives. And it's just such a good thing to do. You will feel better for it.
Shirley Clerken, thank you so much for coming on the Heritage Council podcast. You're a star. Thank you so much.
Thanks a million. So enjoyed it.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for listening to the Heritage Council podcast. For more information about our projects and programs, our work with others and our publications, please check our website, heritagecouncil.ie. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or LinkedIn, or subscribe to our YouTube channel. See you again soon.